All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with verses 2 through 4. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living may take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart will be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. And we left off here with point 38, the last portion of the verse, dealing here with verse 3, has been understood in several ways. But the contrast is clearly between the external countenance and the internal reality. In 39, although the Hebrew term roah, bad or sad, can have moral connotations, it is best to understand it here as the pained or troubled expression of one that is dealing with the reality of death and grief. The whole context here suggests that death and grief and all of that are the background of this. And the Nehemiah passage was just one in where the king asked him, "Why is your face sad?" And it uses the very same term there. So I would take this as a person that's visibly upset, again, most likely from having to deal with the reality of death and the associated grief and distress that goes with that. So 40, the fact that his face betrays his internal pain, distress, or sorrow indicates that he is confronting the reality of loss and separation that comes at the point of death. 41, just how the distressed face relates to the good heart has prompted several interpretations. One, some say it as, see it as saying rather that appearances can be deceiving, and that a sad face may hide a happy heart. And in support of this, they often cite Proverbs 14:13. And of course, obviously, this being one of Solomon's writings, so the question becomes, well, is this what he was getting at? I don't think it is. Because again, to take the imperfect strictly as being incomplete action here, the face is already sad. And it looks to me to be dealing with a future happiness that comes once one has experienced some sort of grief or sorrow that later on down the road is modified and becomes happiness. So even, and they cite this verse, of course, here, even in laughter, the heart may be in pain, and the end of joy may be grief. But now, of course, that is saying just the opposite of what our verses say. He's talking about the person who's externally happy and joyful and all of that may be suffering internally, while this is saying that the person who's obviously suffering externally, and showing that they're suffering at any rate, may have some other end in view. So B, others suggest a paradox between sorrow and the experience of it, which may bring some long-term benefit to the heart. And that's the one I would tend to go with, is the second one here, that when you experience sorrow, while it is not a pleasant thing at the time, the fact is when you come out of that and you recover from it, you're a stronger person. You have greater capacity for life. And in that regard, you also have things to offer to other people that you didn't have before. For instance, it's easy to be glib when people are confronting difficult situations and to make light of it, when in fact that's not what they need. But if you've been through the difficult situation, it tends to make you think more of what a person may need in that situation. And so it's much easier to yield to give some legitimate comfort. And in fact, Paul alludes to this in 2 Corinthians, it occurs to me, that Paul alludes to this with respect to the difficulties he went through in his ministry and the things that he faced. And as a spiritual leader, Paul recognized that things weren't always easy. They're not going to be always easy for anybody. But 2 Corinthians chapter 1, he writes about the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, verse 3, the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort, recognizing that mercy and comfort come from God first. and for who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we will be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the same comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. And so obviously, as you go through difficult situations, you have more capacity for understanding how people feel that are in those same situations and the difficulty of dealing with them. And you don't tend to offer, again, this sort of glib, superficial advice like Solomon's friends, or Solomon, Job's friends offer him. Well, Job, you know, God's for the righteous. No, I didn't. Job, you know God doesn't bless the wicked. No, I didn't. Of course Job knew all this. And that was very bad advice and was very misguided. And so obviously as you suffer and you get comfort as you go through things and you grow through things. Another whole thing that's not really mentioned here, but certainly a reality, is that this often can promote spiritual growth, that you can deal with issues that you normally otherwise wouldn't deal with or may not even want to. So just as the sufferings, verse 5, of Christ are ours in abundance, so also our comfort is abundant through Christ. But if we are afflicted, it is for your comfort and deliverance. Or if we are comforted, it is for your comfort, which is effective in the patient enduring of the same sufferings which we also suffer. And Paul let the believers know under his charge that, look, you may see me suffering. You may see me being blessed, as it were. At a certain level, Paul says, it's all for you. That the reason I go through all of this is for you, because you're going to share in some of these very same things. You're not going to get around them. And our hope for you is firmly grounded, knowing that as you are sharers of our sufferings, so also you are sharers of our comfort. And so I tend to, again, look to the paradox between sorrow and the experience of it and the comfort and the joy and happiness that comes out of that long term. See, Gordas thinks Solomon is saying that one with the sad face reflects the reality of life and death and thus has a wise mind. So 42, the verb yatav here is used with the noun lave, heart or mind, in other places. And it often means to be happy, merry, or contented from food or drink, Judges 19, 6 and 9. And all of us have probably had the experience of you've gone out to eat or ate at home or whatever, but you had a great meal, some great food and drinks together, and possibly fellowship, and at the end of it all, you were very satisfied. It was quite satisfying to you. And again, those situations, we know, are fine, but they are also temporal. They don't last forever. Judges here, 19:6. So both of them sat down and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to the man, please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry. They're using the very same combination of verb and noun, translated merry. And then also he uses it again in verse 9. Behold, now the day is drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here that your heart may be merry. In other words, just be contented and stay here, and we'll feed you and put you up and all that. It's also used in Ruth 3:7. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. There the idea was, again, from satiation, from food or drink, or both, the contentment that comes from that. Again, Mary almost had, he may have been real, I don't think he was giddy, but it's also used another time in 1 Kings 21:7. So, it kind of has the satisfaction, again, or contentment for the heart to be good, as it were, is to be contented, to be satisfied. Job 21:7, Jezebel, his wife, said to him, "Do you now reign over Israel? Arise, eat bread, and let your heart be joyful." There it's translated as joyful. In other words, stop being depressed about this. Because Ahab was busy. He was under his lust grid trying to get this guy's vineyard that he wanted. Well, 43, given the grammar and the context, it would seem more likely that Solomon is acknowledging that sorrow is better than laughter because it will finally give way to a better situation. Psalm 35, and that probably is the verse I was alluding to earlier. Dealing in both with, in this case, divine discipline, his anger is for a moment, but his favor is for a lifetime. That God may discipline you, and when God does discipline you, number one, never lose sight of the fact that you deserve it. You brought it on yourself. God doesn't just arbitrarily discipline us. In that regard, God is so much better than a human parent could ever be. Luke alludes to this in the book of Hebrews. We had earthly parents who disciplined us according to their best wisdom, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? And so anytime God discipline comes upon you, and the discipline may be short-lived, it may be day, maybe hours, maybe a week, maybe months, could be disciplined for a long period of time. Never lose sight of the fact that, number one, even in the discipline, God is still for you. That even in your mistakes, and, you know, we probably everybody would look back, I would assume, and say, well, there's things, if you could change certain things, would you? Well, yeah, sure, we all probably have regrets. But let's face it, the person you are today is because of your mistakes as well as your successes. Your failures contribute just as much in some point to who you are as your successes. Now, if people want to take this and run with it and say, well, see, Ron said I could just fail because that's not going to hurt me. It's not what I said. It's not what I meant. But if people want to twist it, I don't think any of you do, but I never, you know, you can't be too careful. But I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the fact is, when you succeed, and sometimes when you get under discipline, doesn't it make you all that much more determined not to repeat it? And so in that regard, it has a very good effect on you long term, not to repeat that error. And so again, and we all have areas of weakness under your STA. You've got areas where you probably have made great strides and you don't commit those types of sins any longer, or not nearly as much as you did. And then you got areas that just eat your lunch every day. And it's like you just, you know, it drives you to distraction, that aspect of your sin nature. So, again, weeping may last for the night. But even in the midst of your failures, your discipline and all of that, God is for you. His favor is for a lifetime. It transcends these moments of weakness and these failures and the discipline that comes with those things. And we could all probably take turns today. Okay, what did you do this week that got you into trouble with God? And everybody probably have a story. If not, well, you'll have one next week then. But it happens. It's just the way life is. You're not going to get away from the sin nature. Again, this ongoing battle that you're not able to do what you want because the sin nature prohibits you from being sinless. And you're not able to do what you want because the Holy Spirit checks the sin nature. So these two are at odds with each other, and they fight. So weeping may last for the night, but a shout of joy comes in the morning. And again, what the whole point, I think, what Solomon's getting at here too, is that even in grief and sorrow and all of that, it's temporary. And so one of the things, like, we look at life, as Solomon did, and he said, look, all these things are transient. They're vain. They pass by. They're quick. They're momentary. And when you're dealing with good things in life, like happiness and joy and contentment, you wish they weren't transient. But then there's other aspects of life like sorrow and distress and pain and mourning and all that, and we're glad they are transient. And so at a certain level, I think another whole thing in this whole book overall is he is saying at some level you have to embrace the transience. You have to recognize this is the way it is, and you either have to embrace it or you're going to be frustrated. Because you're never going to find ultimate contentment. You're never going to find the ultimate answer. Again, what is the ultimate answer? Well, you have to find the ultimate question. And so who's going to do that? And if it, for again, for those of you seeing the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the answer is 42. So now that we know that, we can move on. But does that satisfy you? And I'll never forget that scene in that movie where it tells the ultimate answer is 42. What? Well, what's the question? Well, 6 times 7. Now, is that really the ultimate question? The human existence, to explain life. So the answer is you're never going to find the ultimate answer. That's the answer. That's Solomon's way of saying this through this book. You're never going to find the ultimate answer. There's your answer. So if you're not going to find the ultimate answer, what ought you to do? Fear God and keep His commandments. Well, 44, beyond that, there are some lessons that we can learn and take to heart when we are confronted with the sorrows of life that we cannot learn from hearing jokes and pursuing good times. Now, would you rather go to a party and have some fun and cut loose? Well, sure. But what will come out of that long term? Probably very little. And once the party's over, you'll be at home in bed, and if you overindulge, you'll be nursing a headache the next day. And but when you deal with difficult issues, the things that are saddening, things that are sorrowful, things that cause you to grieve, and all of that, well, these also pass, but you learn from that. I mean, there are certain things that happened, even recently that happened, that I look at them and I think, well, there's got to be some lessons here. What's the lesson for me, though, in this? And so you try to grow and do the right thing and advance and move on. So verse 45 here, in verse 4, Solomon actively repeats the thought of verse 2 by contrasting two different types of people and two different views and approaches to life. Well, A, the wise man is contrasted with the fool. That's not very hard to figure out here in verse 4. The mind of the wise and the mind of fools. B, the house of mourning is contrasted with the house of feasting, which symbolized the very serious side of life as compared to the flippant pursuit of fun. And again, we're not saying, and I don't think Solomon's saying, he's not saying there's no place for fun. Never have fun. And he's not saying you got to be constantly consumed with these weighty matters of life. But you ought to consider them, is his point, I believe. And again, given the fact that he's targeting a younger audience, this is not typically the types of view they're going to have. And he's telling them, look, I'm a wise guy. Not a wise guy, but a wise man. And I'm a wise guy, and you'll listen. but I'm a wise man, and I've been through this, and these are things you might not think about as a young person. And you wouldn't think about. I didn't think about this at 18, did you? I didn't think about it at 25. Or 30 even. So when do people mature? Well, it depends on when their thinking matures. So again, the important point here, which is not to be missed, point C, is that the heart of the wise man and the heart of the fool each goes to his house of choice. And D, this does not mean that wise men busy themselves with attending funerals on a regular basis, or that fools are busy partying every night. You can be an absolute damn fool and not party for months. Still be a fool. It doesn't mean that that they do this all the time. And in fact, it doesn't mean that they do it at all. It really has to do with where their thinking is. It's talking about the mind of the wise man or the heart of the wise man, what he reflects on. And the heart of the fool, what does he reflect on? So E, it gets to the nature of the character. Men do what is in harmony with their inner nature, which determines what they choose to consider and where their thinking gravitates. See, at a certain level, you know, the thinking is a funny thing. Because you can go through, you know, as you go through your day, you choose to think about certain things. Like right now, if you're hungry, which some of you shouldn't be, you know who you are. You might be thinking about, where am I going to eat lunch? but you control your thinking. And then at other times, it's almost as though thoughts just pop into your head. And you might wonder, well, where do these thoughts come from? You know, did I think that? And so the thinking is kind of a funny thing. But people tend to think about certain things. There are certain things their mind gravitates toward. If I wake up in the middle of the night, I mean, you know, you get old, you don't always sleep as well as you did when you were younger and all that. And I'll lay there, and if I'm working on a hard verse, my mind immediately gravitates right to what I was thinking about you know, these verses. Like the ones coming up I'm studying in chapter 7. They're difficult. Not that all of them have been real easy, but to this point. But some of them are, you know, they're going to challenge you. When Solomon says, "I found one man among 1,000, but I can't find a woman." Okay. That doesn't sound good on the surface. So women are absolutely worthless, and most men are worthless. Well, that's, you know, well, women aren't absolutely worthless. Number one, I'm pretty sure that's not what he's saying as I go into this. But I may have to modify my views and say women are absolutely, you know. No, I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying, but I haven't got to what he's saying. That's the whole point. But I know this verse has been on my mind for like weeks now. I'm like, you know, I find my mind gravitating to what's important to me in my life. And that's what he's saying here about the fools and wise men. They think about what's important to them. And fools think about having fun and making life easy on themselves and all that. Whereas the wise man considers more weighty matters. But the wise man also doesn't get bogged down. That's one of the things we're going to see coming up. It's easy to get bogged down in the weighty matters of life. So there again, there's a balance to all this that we're going to see, because he'll make these statements and then he turns around and modifies them. And he says, okay, look, it's better to do this than this. And then later on in the chapter, he'll say, you would think, well, okay, then one should be wise and all that. And then he says, don't be excessively wise. So there's a point at which wisdom becomes counterproductive, we might say. So again, people, their thinking gravitates to what's important to them. And the wise man and the fool here demonstrate at some level what they are by what they think about. And they recognize, the wise man recognizes life is serious. The fool doesn't tend to recognize how serious it all is. You're only going to get one shot at this life. And as I was sitting there last night, as I was sitting and watching this musical, I was reflecting on Johnny Cash and his life. And I thought, you know, for him, it's over. He's lived his life. It's done. And he only got one shot at it. And that's all of us are going to get. And so the reality is, Johnny Cash, in some ways, reminds me, strangely enough, of Solomon. Only he could sing better. But he went through this period in his life. He was exposed to the truth. He was a believer from a pretty young age. And he went through this period of life where he basically blew it all off and pursued Funsville. Sound like anybody we've been studying. And for Johnny Cash, of course, Funsville was cocaine and downers and goofballs. Lots of booze and partying and all of that. Now, who's not to say Solomon didn't do the same thing? I don't know that he didn't. You know, I don't know if they'd synthesized cocaine at that time, but who knows? So, but then towards the end of his life, he recognized the stupidity and the folly of all that he had done. And he got his act together. And his last album reflects all this. That he recognizes that, you know, I've blown it at a certain level. And I think that's one of the reasons Solomon writes, to say, you know, I've blown it at a certain level. Don't do what I did. But that's, you know, again, when you're dealing with younger people, they don't like hearing that, you know, do as I say, not as I did, because they tend to reject that. But Solomon went through this whole, you know, thing too. And he blew part of his life. But at the end of it all, he kind of pulls it together and recognizes, hey, this is what's important. And there's a balance here to life that, you know, had I seen maybe earlier, maybe I would have done different. So 46, in keeping with what he has stated so far in this section, Solomon reinforces his view that those who are wise will spend some time contemplating their ultimate destiny, while those that are foolish often blithely live as if they will not die. The fool is very short-sighted, of that we can be sure. The fool doesn't consider the long-term consequences of his actions. He just sees what he wants to do right now. Fools tend to be pretty emotional types too. And they react on their emotions and they live off of them. And it causes them to make bad decisions. And they tend to not look to the long-term consequences of their decisions. So 47, Solomon is not suggesting that we should spend all our time attending funerals or that we should never enjoy ourselves. He is pointing out which type of mindset and course of action will be most beneficial to us in the long run. In 48, Abraham ben Meir ibn Ezra, And if you'll often see this just shortened down to Eben Ezra. And sometimes it's spelled with an E, Eben Ezra and Aben Ezra. Who was a Jewish writer in the Middle Ages, is quoted as saying, even when the wise do not go to the house of mourning, the house of mourning is always within them. And I think that's the point at which Solomon's getting at here. You have this sort of sense that tempers life, that, you know, life can be fun, but it's also tempered with the fact that life is serious, and it's supposed to be serious. Okay, well, from that, we'll go to the next one. Correction is better than distraction. Verse 5, it is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. Well, Solomon's already, he hasn't said it yet, but it's coming up at the end of the chapter. He said, I found one among 1,000 men, and I assume he's referring that were wise or trustworthy, and none women. But let's face it, and I wonder if he picked the 1,000 arbitrarily, or if this is a reference to how many women in the household he had to deal with. And one thing I do know is he's dealing with a particular type of woman. I don't think he's dealing with all women in general. Okay, better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. Again, the good from the masculine singular noun, tov. Good to listen, prefix lamed here, plus the cal infinitive construct of shamah, shamayin. To listen, to pay attention. Again, while I translate it listen, the idea here of it is to listen so that you take it to heart. It's not just to hear it, it's to act upon it, to pay attention to it. It is better to listen. And then you've got the feminine singular noun construct of, what do we got here? Geara, apostrophe A-R-A-H. The root, the verb, means to a check applied to someone via strong admonitions or actions, to try to curb somebody from doing something. Here, it refers to a verbal check. Like, stop it. That's a verbal check. Or a reproof or a rebuke. And it's a construct. Better to hear, a rebuke of the wise is actually generic. They make it definitive here. They put the article there, but it's an arthrous in the Hebrew. A rebuke of a wise man. Any rebuke from any wise man, in other words, that's why it's an arthrous. He's not talking about a particular wise man, only one wise man. He's talking about wise men in general and the types of rebukes they might offer. Better to listen to a check or a rebuke from a wise man, from the preposition men is the better than literally a man or an individual. They've translated it for one. It's for a man, an individual, ish, I-Y-S-A. This particularizes it rather than using Adam. Then for a person, we might say, an individual. Listening, calactive participle of shaman. Now, this is important here. S-H-A-M-A, same verb here, but the first one was an infinitive, to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. And now you got a calactive participle, ongoing action, one that's regularly listening to. Listening to the songs is shir, S-H-I-Y-R. My boss's daughter is named Shira, which means a song. So a song of fools, Kasil, is again the fools and folly vocabulary. This is it, K-E-S-I-Y-L. Again, fools, dullards. The emphasis is on those that make bad choices. Again, not on mental defects. It's those who do not make the choices to line up their life with what's good or right or proper. It's those who are consistently making bad choices. Let's look at the music industry now. And let's look at who are our role models. Green Day, Madonna, Britney, who else? Avril Lavigne? Who are the popular singers out there? Who are in the top 40? And we don't have to limit this simply to pop culture. In the country industry, Although I'll have to admit, the country industry tends to be tempered with a little more religion than, say, you know, some of the others. But, I mean, do I want to listen to Snoop Dogg and 50 Cent? Are they my role models? Yeah, that's it. Well, these are the songs of fools. And what are they singing about? In most cases, nothing. In most cases, the songs aren't even of consequence. Now, that's not to say some of them aren't. For instance, if you're familiar with Green Day, they got a song, When September Ends. And it's about the guy's, it's a song about the death of the guy's dad. And it's very somber, and it focuses on an important issue, death. But most people don't like the song because it's kind of a downer. It's not their typical stuff. But, and they sing, you know, some songs have, you know, a decent message. Don't want to be an American idiot. Well, what are the odds? Unfortunately, it's good. So it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man, singular instance here, than to keep on listening than a man that's regularly listening to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, conjunction key here, which introduces an explanation, because... like is, they've translated it as here, the inseparable preposition kaf, which is just a K in the Hebrew, is usually sets up a comparison, like or as. For as the sound or voice, and in this case we would translate it sound, and then you've got this word seer, S-I-Y-R, 34 times, there appear to be two homonyms here. One means a dry, thorny branch or plant. For instance, that's the way it's used in Isaiah 34:13. Isaiah 34:13 talks about a destruction. And thorns will come up in its fortified towers. Nestles and thistles in its fortified cities. It will be the haunt of jackals and an abode of ostriches. And it's also, there's another word that's used, same thing, spelled the same, Exodus 16:3, which appears to mean a cauldron or a pot. And the New American Standard reflects that this homonym situation, because it translates them differently. Exodus 16:3, then the sons of Israel said, we wish we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt. By then, Moses is probably thinking, yeah, that's two of us. Me too. You're preaching to the choir. I wish you'd have died there too. When we sat by the pots of meat, there they translate it by the word pot. Clearly, thistles would not work there. Or nettles. For the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot. And then you've got the preposition tachath, C-A-T-H-A-T-H, and then you have under, and then the definite article under the pot. And then you've got seer again, it's the very same word. So you have it used, again, there's a word play in here in the Hebrew, it appears. Thus, or so, adverb, ken, K-E-N, thus is the laughter of a fool. You got the masculine singular noun construct of sekok, S-E-C-H-O-Q. Thus is the laughter of the fool. Definite article again, plus kasil, same vocabulary. And this too is futility. And is a wow here too, also, indeed, even as the conjunction gam. This, masculine singular adjective, this situation, is vanity. Hevel, our same word that is used throughout the book. Vanity, transient, pointless. For oppression makes a wise man mad. Because, here, conjunction, explanatory again, key, he further adds something here. Because the oppression, literally, definite article plus the masculine singular noun of Oshek, Osheq, O-S-H-E-Q. It's used in, this same word's used in Ecclesiastes 5:7. 14 times it's used. Ecclesiastes 5:7 talks about. It's 5:8 in the English version. It's 5:7 in the Hebrew version. Change that to 5:8 for our purposes. If you see the oppression of the poor, the verbal root denotes the abuse of power or authority by burdening, oppressing, or crushing those of lower station. Those most likely to be oppressed, again, were those that were without adequate means and ways to protect their rights. So it tended to be the lower classes of people, the widow, the orphan, the foreigner, or the poor person. And in many cases, the oppression has to do with financial robbery or extortion. You had active ways and passive ways in which they could get money from people. Actively, they might oppress them. Passively, they might extort from them. It still is active, I guess, at that level, but not in one sense. So, oppression here. And this gets into a financial extortion. We've had people try to blackmail us and extort us. This doesn't work. You don't have to put up with that. That is a horrible way to approach life. To attempt to blackmail people. I mean, good God. Get a life. Oppression makes a wise man. Here, the word here means kalal. You actually have a poel imperfect of halal. H-A-L-A-L. It's a hay, not a ket. Normally, the word means to shine or flash forth. The poel stem appears to have a different meaning. It's used only five times and means to make somebody look foolish. For instance, Job 12:17 uses this same stem. And context here would dictate verse 16, he's talking about God. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The misled and the misleader belong to him. He even controls this aspect of life. The misleader and those he misleads. And he makes counselors walk barefoot. And he makes fools of judges. In other words, makes judges look foolish. Because God is superior in wisdom and all of that. And it's also used like this in Isaiah 44, verse 25. For oppression, and this gets into financial attempts to extort or blackmail, makes a wise man, and the word mad here would be better translated, makes a fool out of a wise man, makes him look foolish. It's not mad as in the sense of angry, nor is it mad in the sense of insane. There's another verb for that. Or even another noun. So oppression makes a wise man look foolish. Isaiah 44, 25. Causing the omens of boasters to fail. People see certain things, they're bragging about their plans, they say, we see the signs are all for us. And they think they're good at reading the signs. Well, guess what? They're not. The arrogant are not good at reading signs and making fools out of diviners, causing wise men to draw back and turning their knowledge into foolishness. So again here, the word would be better translated, oppression makes a wise man foolish or makes him look foolish. And a bribe corrupts the heart. A wise man is actually the masculine singular adjective, kakam. And PL imperfect here now, the verb leads this off and is perished or destroyed. They've translated it as corrupted. Avad, A-B-H-A-D-H. The word means, again, to be lost, like you could lose something. To perish or to be destroyed. They've translated it corrupts because they're trying to get to what the effect is on the person long term. It's not like they're destroyed, as in wiped out. But when you get into the heart here, the sign of the direct object, which is simply E-T-H in the Hebrew, and then the word heart here, lev, L-E-B-A. And in this case, the heart sometimes the heart refers to the thinking. I mean, they didn't have a bunch of separate words to denote the various facets of human function. And the heart here would get into the higher moral standards. When you get into being destroyed or corrupted, we're talking about norms and standards, and we're getting into the issue of the conscience here. And that's the way, one of the ways the word heart is used. It's used for the conscience. And a bride can corrupt the conscience or destroy the conscience. And that's not good. And the word bride here is the feminine singular noun here, matana. M-A-T-T-A-N-A-H. Matana, normally the word is used of presents or gifts, which can be good, obviously, and in one connotation. But here we're talking about judicial bribery. We're talking about attempting to extort or bribe people to do what you want them to do. And he said this can destroy the conscience, can wipe it out. Okay, point one here. Verse 5 continues with another one of the better than thing, proverbs. I know I got things in there, but another one of the better than proverbs, which would appear to be connected to what was stated in the previous verse. Again, you get into the connection may be a little more tenuous, but certainly here we had the idea of the mind of the wise and the mind of the fools. And then he continues on here with the thinking with respect to the wise man. So I can see at least a progression, a train of thought here with this one. Two, it would certainly seem that the Song of Fools in our verse continues the theme of frivolity that was expressed by the phrase house of pleasure. There is, again, I think at any rate here, a train of thought through here that goes from the idea of death, the birthday and the death day in chapter or verse 1, to what comes out of death, the house of mourning, all the funeral home, and all of that kind of stuff. And then looking at the opposite of that, the house of feasting, the house where, again, life is being celebrated, whether a birth or a wedding or whatever, a festive occasion. And then the contrast between sorrow and laughter, and that ultimately sorrow can have a great benefit in the life. And then contrasting the two types of people, the mind of the wise, where their mindset is, and the mind of fools. And then continuing on here with the rebuke of the wise, as he continues with his thought. So 3, verse 4, in verse 4 we saw the wise and the foolish. Both of which were identified by their mindset with respect to mourning and feasting. Point 4, in verse 5, Solomon contrasts the rebuke of a singular wise man with the mirth that is characteristic of a plurality of fools. 5, in some ways, the rebuke of a wise man has characteristics similar to a funeral. Both may be hard to experience. But both are of more value in terms of orienting one to reality in the long run. And that's one of the purposes, of course, that he set forth there in the concept of the funeral, is that's the end of every man. That's the reality of it all. We're all going to die. So in the long run, one would be wise to orient to that reality rather than ignore it, pretend it doesn't exist, or that somehow you're going to get around it, because you're not. 6, the fact that the first is singular and the second group is plural would suggest that the songs of fools are somewhat more prolific than actual rebukes from a wise man. And again, all you have to do is look at the music industry, and there's millions of songs of fools out there. Some are not necessarily as bad as others. Some have much more satanic overtones to them. I mean, there's great variations even in music out there. I mean, there's quite a bit of difference between listening, say, to Ozzy Osbourne and Jackson Browne. Quite a wide difference there. There's great variations, but the fact is there are way more songs of fools available than there are wise men today. And hence, less rebukes as well. Seventh, the first half of this proverb certainly accords with the wisdom tradition in Israel, which exalted the value of accepting timely verbal correction. Psalm 141:5. And the wise person, in this case David, recognized the value of a good rebuke when necessary. And David, as the king, did not, from what he says here, certainly doesn't appear to me to have considered himself above it. And nobody is. And in some cases, you need to hear people telling you you're wrong. That's unfortunately what the correction is. That is just a part of life. And those that seek to get around that are going to find out that, guess what? Just because you think it doesn't make it right. And from time to time, you need to be told you're wrong. It doesn't hurt you. It does at the time. I mean, it's not pleasant. Nobody likes it. Let the righteous, and this is an important point here, again, it's not just that you listen to everybody and every criticism and everything they say. That is just as dumb as not listening. Because in many cases, then you're just listening to somebody with an axe to grind. You're listening to somebody with a hidden agenda. You can listen to people under their STAs. And if you take all that to heart, you're going to be way off balance. Because you have to recognize that everybody that talks doesn't necessarily have something to say. I mean, they may have something to say, but it may not be worth listening to is the whole point. So a lot of people talk. A lot of people have things to say. But let the righteous smite me in kindness. And that's another whole issue in getting to all of this. What are people's mental attitude motivation behind all this? There are some people, there is, as a proverb says, there is a man whose speaking is as the piercing of a sword. That's not the being smitten in kindness type mentality. So let him smite me in kindness and reprove me. It is oil on my head, and do not let my head refuse it. For still my prayer is against their wicked deeds. And so David just says, look, okay, I want to be reproved by the right kind of person in the first place. If I have to be told that I'm wrong. Number one, it needs to come from the right kind of person, not just from anybody. There are a bunch of people, again, who are more than happy to tell you you're wrong, but what is their agenda? What is their motivation? What's their mental attitude behind all that? Also, Proverbs 6:23. And of course, this is, we could have cited a lot of verses here. I only cited a few here, but for the commandment is a lamp. The teaching of doctrine, getting the word of God before you is what enlightens you. It's what throws light on your life and on your Christian way of life and how you are to walk and how you are to live it. And the teaching is a light. And reproofs for discipline. Reproof, again, is simply being told you're wrong. Reproofs for discipline are the way of life. And so those who reject all this, they reject whatever reproof, they reject authority, they're laws to themselves, essentially. They're not on the way of life, I can tell you that much. Whatever they are doing, they're not on the way of life. Because this is the way of life according to the wisdom tradition in Israel. Proverbs 13:1. A wise son accepts his father's discipline, but a scoffer does not listen to a rebuke. And you can tell a scoffer he's wrong repeatedly. You can tell him he was wrong till you're blue in the face. It's not going to change him. He's not going to listen to it, i.e. he's not going to take it to heart. Doesn't mean he doesn't hear it, but he's not going to take it to heart. And in many cases, when you see this verb listen, it gets, again, not just to hearing something, not just to listening to it, but taking it to heart and acting upon it. Also, verse 18, poverty and shame will come to him who neglects discipline. But he who regards reproof will be honored. And so there's some phase two promises, again, associated with dealing with difficult decisions, hearing things that may not be pleasant, and then taking them to heart. And the bigger thing, again, is acting upon them. Proverbs 15:31 also. He whose ear listens to the life-giving reproof. And again, reproof and all is tied to the way of life. There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end of that is the way of death. And again, many people don't want to be told, you know, you're just wrong. You have just missed the point of all of this. You have completely missed the point. And as long as you continue to miss the point, you're not going to dwell among the wise. That's just the way it is. It doesn't work any other way. He who neglects discipline despises himself. But he who listens to reproof acquires understanding. And also chapter 25, verse 12. But again, as we're going to see, as I dealt with this and as I thought about it, as David pointed out there in the psalm, there's a type of person that you want to listen to, and there are many types of people you don't want to listen to. Because they, while they may have a lot to say, it may not be worth hearing. Proverbs 25:12, like an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, is a wise reprover to a listening ear. Now that's another important point in all of this, which we are going to have to wait till Wednesday to deal with. But the idea is a wise reprover. There is a way to do things in the Christian life. There is a way to handle things with wisdom. Some people may have something to say. Let's say their point is valid and even needs to be heard. If they don't go about it right, there's every chance they'll never be listened to. Even if they're correct, they're not going to be listened to. Why? Because they violate decorum. They violate the wise way to go about things. And there is, as we're going to see coming up even in Ecclesiastes, there is a particular decorum when dealing with the king. And those who do not, who neglect that or avoid it or ignore it, will find, sadly, that their position before the king is jeopardized. And he's going to deal with that. And of course, he writes as a king. He writes as one that had the ultimate authority in Israel. And so he would know. All right, well, our time is gone, so let's stop there and we will continue on here Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of considering these issues. We pray that God the Holy Spirit will sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.